This episode is an exclusive insight into the views of the LGIM investment team on what's happening in markets and what this means for investors. This podcast is intended for investment professionals. If you're enjoying LGIM Talks, why not subscribe in your Apple Podcast or Spotify app to make sure you never miss an episode.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Emil van den Heiligenberg, Head of Asset Allocation, Madeline King, Co-Head of Global Investment Grade Research, and Nigel Masding, Senior Fund Manager. This is our first call since early July, when we moved the update to a monthly basis. So with no further ado, let me turn to you, Sonia. Firstly, good morning. And can you walk us through the latest virus developments and the health of the global economy?
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Max. And good morning, everyone. Given that it's been quite a while that we last spoke and updated you, first and foremost, I hope that you are dialing in healthy and safe, and that obviously you are continuing to cope well with the ongoing flurry of news around the coronavirus. As you can see, we have one more speaker today, and the reason is that obviously quite a lot has happened, and we wanted to make sure that we are covering more market aspects across the asset classes, because clearly we have been through Q2 results season, and there's a lot of very interesting takeaways that we would like to share with you today. So I will start, as usual, with a few words on the virus situation, and then would like to run you through our latest economic thinking. But it's very clear that we are seeing a lot more news flow again on the virus, probably as expected. We're in the middle of peak holiday season, and not surprisingly, we are now seeing a lot more measures being imposed globally, mostly around travel restrictions, quarantines, compulsory mask wearing, down to regional lockdowns, as we've seen from cities like Melbourne or Leicester. And this is obviously against the backdrop of daily new cases reaching nearly 300,000. And that's a number that obviously we should not forget. We're not at the end of this yet. And as you can see here on the slide, we're seeing a bit of a mixed shift, but globally the picture still remains rather unsettling. And as such, I think our expectation by now has to be that regional measures and varying degrees of lockdown probably will remain the story of the rest of the year, potentially even in 2021, depending on when a vaccine can be found. Vaccines in particular, I think, again, we've had a lot of news flow, and obviously we know that there's a number of companies globally that are looking to develop vaccines. I think optimism, to be fair, has been on the up, because there is expectations that we can probably see more broad-based testing and then obviously production and distribution happening earlier. But we have to be realistic. It's not a done deal yet. And as such, obviously, this is very strongly linked to our view on how quickly we can move through the virus development towards a full normalization. We clearly have learned a lot in the previous months, and it's clear that you can see policymakers and governments are picking up that learning to be more focused in terms of the measures. But it's very clear, for example, mask wearing is clearly something we're seeing more widespread and compulsory applied. And I would imagine that this, alongside social distancing, will probably be the two main very obvious features that will run through until we have a proper vaccine in place. Now, with that in mind and looking at the economic situation, you know that we have initially developed three scenarios, which very quickly then moved towards a two-scenario setup. And how it looks like now is that the central scenario we have settled on sits straight in between scenario one and two. And you might recall that the most important difference between those two scenarios was linked to the effectiveness of governments handling the second wave. We always expected that once you loosen up these lockdown restrictions, that you would see infections rise, and it always came down to how effectively we can manage the second wave that would have then an impact, obviously, on the economic developments. So where we are now, and on this slide you can see our central scenario going forward, is that there is a few dependencies. But it's clear that we have now a lot more information on how the initial recovery has panned out. And we have a bit more insight as well on how particularly July and August have developed. And I would like to focus a bit more on the, you know, on the box on the bottom left, on what our core assumptions are and why we believe that the economic scenario will look like a middle between scenario one and two, which literally means a very strong initial rebound, but then a flattening of the economic growth. And particularly what we assume is that we will not see full output recovery before the end of 2021. To get us there, as we know and as we've discussed in the past, government support and fiscal stimulus will remain incredibly important. And we have talked about economic scarring in the past, and I will come to that in a second. But we do know that obviously the immense liquidity support from governments and central banks have played a vital role why actually we have seen this very swift recovery and why obviously financial markets have been very quick to discount that in market valuation. So we are currently in the middle of the U.S. Congress debating another fiscal package, and there has been quite a lot of back and forth between the Democrats and the Republicans. You know that we potentially now have to wait until early September, and it's not clear yet what the size will be, but it's clear that it is very important that we get another fiscal package for the U.S. We have seen, obviously, unemployment data in particular, and the support for unemployed people is incredibly important to our central economic scenario. The virus development remains a key input factor, and our base assumption, as I've just outlined, obviously is that, yes, we can manage the second wave, but there is still a lot of dependency on particular how we come through the autumn, because one of the key takeaways of our learning is that, obviously, the virus spreads a lot more indoors than outdoors. And as such, obviously, once we approach the autumn and winter season, it remains to be seen how effectively we can manage the virus development. Schools is another one. I'm sure all of you have had these debates across either, you know, in companies and with friends. The school situation is a key to the economic recovery as well, not only in terms of the virus development, but obviously if people have to stay home to provide homeschooling to their children, then obviously they cannot go back to work and there might be some impact on the economic output as such. Moving forward in terms of the economic scarring in the longer term development, first, what you see here on this slide clearly is what I've just outlined. Very strong initial recovery, but a plateauing now, which means obviously that we are in the squarely in the second wave context of more restrictions and obviously a more cautious behavior from individuals in terms of the future. And it will hence highly depend on further support measures on how we see economic development, particular with regards to the labor market. And I will quickly jump one forward because that's the slide we have shared with you a number of times. And it's this understanding that despite the fact that early signs in the labor market are quite encouraging, we should not forget that there is a longer-term reallocation shock that will be visible only in later quarters. And I think it's very clear that if we think about travel and leisure and the recent announcement that we had here, particularly from British Airways in the UK, show you the impact that the pandemic had on the labor force of these sectors. So moving back one, and just to put in context some of the risks up and down that we are seeing around our central scenario, and it's clear that on the upside, it is very much linked to, obviously, the successful management of the virus and earlier arrival of the vaccine so that you really see a full normalization happening earlier, whereas on the downside, you see that we have highlighted, for example, support schemes roll off too early, i.e. this liquidity support being removed too early, which clearly could have a longer-term impact in terms of unemployment rates, bankruptcies, and we would definitely see their lending standards tighten a lot further from here. Another risk, obviously, and this is what I've highlighted earlier, vaccines. Yes, there is a lot of excitement right now, but clearly we don't know yet how effective they actually will be and how quickly we can roll them out. There's already quite a bit of political back and forth, how you know, who should get the first batches and how you distribute vaccines across your country. With that in mind, I will hand over back to Max, because I think it's really important now to establish the link on how markets have reacted to those input factors and what we expect going forward. Max, back to you.
Well, thank you very much for talking us through those shifting dynamics, Sonia. And let's move to Nigel now to talk about markets. Nigel, I understand you're about to go on a dinghy race later today. I'm not sure if there's a metaphor there for stocks, but bigger picture, what have we learned from the Q2 earnings season about how companies have fared during the depths of the crisis? And what does this mean for the outlook for equities?
The metaphor is, on the dinghy race, when I look out the window, it's sunny and calm outside at the moment. But I know there's a storm coming tomorrow, so let's hope that doesn't get replicated in the economics and the virus. Turning to the Q2 results and what we've learned from those, I think the first thing to say is that the Q2 results have told us a lot compared to the Q1 results. If I take people back, the Q1 period was largely pre-crisis, so when companies reported, we focused less on what had happened and more so on the anecdotal insight they gave us in terms of what was about to happen. Whereas the Q2 period this time around has captured the worst of the COVID crisis, what I hope will be the worst of the COVID crisis across most markets, and as such has told us a lot more about how COVID has impacted companies. As expected, the Q2 results were bad. In aggregate, across the MSCI World companies, reported revenues were down 16% year on year. I don't know whether that was a record, but if it isn't, it must be pretty close. But still, that was actually a little bit better than expected outside the oil and gas sector, only modestly better, I'd say. And I think that was largely because there was a slightly faster economic recovery than had been previously expected, and Sonia highlighted that on one of those charts earlier on. And we also know that companies had done, as they always do, done very well at lowering expectations across the market. But perhaps the biggest surprise was that earnings didn't fall as much as expected. The bottom chart, which covers earnings, is a little bit messy, or very messy, I should say, and that's because forecasting the outturn had a high level of dispersion across companies and sectors. But overall, when I look at all these companies, they did a lot better on earnings as cost control was more effective than anticipated, and we saw less operating leverage on the downside. And I've put that down to three things. Many companies, particularly in Europe, benefited handsomely from the government subsidy schemes that came through, such as the various employee furlough schemes. The second thing is that companies were very swift at the beginning of the quarter, so back in April time period, at cutting variable costs, such as promotional activity. I think that was made very easy for them when the lockdowns came in, so they just stopped spending on various areas. And then the final thing to point out is that probably some sectors that benefited some very favorable dynamics in the quarter. Two, I would point to our financials, where the investment banks did particularly well out of issuance revenues and trading revenues. And in fact, the oil and gas sector had the same benefit in their trading divisions as well. The other observation I've made from this slide is it starts to show the divergence in performance we've seen across the range of sectors. On the right-hand side are broadly the sectors who have had a good crisis. Everyone knows that technology has done very well, and they, as this graph shows, had the best performance over the quarter in terms of both revenues and earnings. The other defensive sectors also performed very well, as you would probably expect. So that's healthcare, telecoms, and utilities. The outlier here is financials, who, one, benefited from all that trading and issuance revenue. But what's really going to happen to them is provisioning, which isn't a revenue item, and that is likely still ahead for much of the sector, and we'll still see that in subsequent quarters. On the left-hand side are the sectors that have had a tougher crisis, where they're directly exposed to social distancing and the lockdowns, such as the consumer areas, or more generally, the more cyclical sectors. This can be seen when we look at the performance of individual companies as opposed to looking at the sector aggregates. When I look across all of the results, I looked at and read about and talked to companies over the second quarter, there are two broad trends that I'd highlight. The first one, I think, is the more obvious one. There were clearly companies who were on the wrong and right side of the lockdowns and the virus, and correspondingly saw a large impact on their revenues. The second theme or trend is that strong companies are getting stronger versus their competitors, even when they're impacted by the same virus trends. Just focusing on that first of those trends, it's very clear who the clear winners and losers are in terms of revenues. If you're an airline, a cruise company, a pub group, an oil company, a clothing retailer, or even a company that supplies operating theatres for elective surgeries, life is very tough during the second quarter, as you probably have anticipated. On the other hand, if you're an investment bank, a supermarket, a company producing hygiene products, or even producing computer peripherals and other home working software that we've all used a lot more, you're likely to have had a pretty good quarter. But for most companies, it's a lot more complex. Just to give you an example, Diageo, which is famous for its whiskey, gin, and of course Guinness, in the US, it performed very well. That's because 80% of its products are consumed at home, and that volume went up, more than offsetting declines in pubs and bars. Whereas in Europe, it had a tough time. Their revenue split is 50-50 between home and out of home. And while home demand was good, it could never offset the 50% out of home that largely collapsed to near zero. Turning to the stronger, getting stronger, this has been a persistent theme that we've seen playing across between companies and between competitors. I've listed here a few reasons why the strong are thriving and doing very well. Just to give you one specific UK example, which is perhaps a little bit exaggerated, but it's helpful, the importance of low debt when businesses when business becomes tough. In the UK, we've got two large budget hotel chains, Premier Inn and Travelodge. Premier Inn entered the crisis with 2.5 times net debt to EBITDA. It had to close all its hotels, but successfully raised fresh equity capital, and its balance sheet is well placed to support it to thrive post-crisis when it opens up the hotels. Whereas Travelodge had more than 7 times net debt to EBITDA going into the crisis. It struggled to raise fresh capital and had to stop paying rent to its landlords. It now faces the prospect of losing many of its hotels as the landlords move away from it. And its performance is going to be compromised severely going forwards.
So, now, Nigel, thanks for that. If I could, I'm just going to jump in because I'm conscious of the time. If you don't mind spending just a few seconds on the outlook, and then I'll turn to Madeline, but I'm watching the clock here.
Sure. Thanks, Max. I think from a company-level perspective, we know a lot more now in terms of how the company crisis impacts various businesses. From the winners and losers, we know what will happen if the virus stays with us, and conversely, what will happen if the virus improves and the relative performance reverses. I suspect, given the depth of the crisis, we'll continue to see the stronger getting stronger. Also, if I look on an aggregated basis, we know that for all the companies we look at, sales expectations have fallen significantly. Just to focus on the two-year numbers, that's 2019-21, the aggregate sales forecast for these companies is now down modestly, so 2021 revenue is expected to be a little lower than 2019. That's very consistent with the GDP forecast that Sonia highlighted earlier. I'd highlight two other outlook thoughts. We're starting to see companies initiate some substantial cost reduction programs, as they do in every recession. This could yet have feedback loops and cause more economic problems or scarring, but might necessitate us to think about lowering our company forecasts further in the future if we see more feedback. And from an investor perspective, it's becoming more challenging for investors to focus their allocation just on the crisis winners, as valuation differentials have widened in the market. Indeed, on some metrics, the valuation differential between growth and value companies has now widened to sort of dot-com type levels. And investors will need to increasingly decide whether to back the more expensive companies that are doing well or to look more at companies where valuations are looking more attractive.
That's great. Thank you, Nigel. And staying with those themes, let's look at corporate debt.
Madeline, how have company earnings affected your view of the credit outlook, in particular with regard to those issuers that are most likely to be recession losers?
Thanks, Max. So we have a slide here that illustrates a different angle on earnings season. So we're looking at it here on slide 27 from a balance sheet perspective. And I think the first thing I would say is that really, if we just look at what this chart tells us, it's that leverage has gone up a lot pretty much across the board. But also that if you look at where those leverage increases have come from, not really a massive surprise that leisure and autos are at the weakest end of that list. So as much as this has been quite an eventful earnings season, in a lot of ways, it hasn't been that surprising. One thing we have illustrated here is that we've stripped out the impact of M&A, because it's very easy to forget because it feels like a long time ago. But actually, balance sheets in the corporate world were generally getting weaker even before COVID. Feels like a long time ago now. But when you add that to the impacts that we've seen this earnings season, it's certainly a negative for balance sheets. But obviously, that's something we did expect going into this earnings season. Now, where we did see surprises, as Nigel has already alluded to, they were mostly actually quite positive, particularly on the profit and cost management side. And pretty much the reason for that is that the government support schemes are working pretty well, and they are cushioning corporates. And the other kind of side of that, absolutely not a surprise, because we've seen it in the market via record bond issuance, that the liquidity positions of companies are really very comfortable right now. Cash balances are high. It's absolutely not a surprise, but it's worth mentioning because it's really important. This is not a liquidity crisis. Corporates have enough cash, and the reason that's important is that basically it buys them some time. So even thinking about the very worst performing companies, the ones who are still in partial shutdown, the ones where we don't really have a good line of sight as to when revenues are going to start to recover, even those ones have adequate liquidity to kind of keep them going for a little bit longer, which is really important. And in terms of the outlook from here, I think it's important to think about the driver of where these leverage increases are coming from, to think about at what point we can start to think about leverage peaking and when it might recover. And essentially, the main driver, there's obviously a few exceptions, it's different sector to sector, but generally, it's the denominator. So here, we're looking at net debt divided by EBITDA, and it's that EBITDA number that's really important here, and it's the fact that that's really cratered that has driven these leverage numbers higher. In some cases, you do also get net debt increasing due to companies burning through cash, but it's really that denominator that's the important number here. So the outlook depends on when that recovers. And because we still have many months of kind of future COVID weakness to come, if we think about this mathematically, H2 2020 will still be, even though it's much better than H1 20, will still be weaker than H1 19. So even until we get to year-end 2020, that's the absolute sort of first point we could even think about leverage peaking. And more likely, we think it's probably going to be a little bit later in 2021. So that's at an average level. And for the very worst-hit companies, where we're not just worried about that really low EBITDA number, but they're also burning through cash, potentially we have to think about government support being taken away. For those very weak companies, that the leverage peak could be much, much later. And then just to finish off, the chart on the right-hand side of that slide, it illustrates what we've seen this earnings season on shareholder returns. So this is just this earnings season. It doesn't cover what we saw in Q1, when we saw a huge number of companies cutting dividends to zero, being very, very conservative. So a lot of that happened already. This season, we did see a few more shareholder payout reductions, which I think links nicely to Nigel's point earlier on those strong getting stronger companies and the importance of low debt. That's exactly what we want to hear as bondholders. So when companies are prioritizing the balance sheet, that's great news for credit. We saw more of that this quarter, the energy sector being the big one, and talking about a permanent rebasement of dividend payments in some cases. But I think what's interesting is we actually saw the reverse in a small number of cases as well, where some companies actually thought that they maybe went a bit too conservative in Q1 in cutting the dividend, and actually their performance has held up pretty well, so they're comfortable resuming that that payout. So just to conclude, overall, in terms of credit quality and rating actions, it's obviously been a very volatile year. We've seen a massive volume of fallen angels earlier in this year. But where we are right now, it's actually kind of, it feels a lot calmer. When we spoke in April about this, it felt like every company we covered was on watch negative, and now that's just not the case anymore. So roughly a quarter of our investable universe is on negative outlook by one of the rating agencies, one or more of the rating agencies, which does suggest that we still have more downgrades to come. But we think the pace will be much, much slower from here. We've basically got a bit of a respite, which I think is exactly what we all need right now.
Right. Well, look, thank you very much for those insights, Madeline. And now, having discussed equities and credit, Emil, what are the asset allocations? What are the asset allocation implications of all of this and the apparent disconnect between markets and the real economy? And of course, how are you positioning tactically and strategically right now? Just keeping an eye on the clock, I'll ask you to speak as briefly as possible, if you can.
Thanks, Max. Well, people who dial in these calls frequently or follow us on the Elgin blog know that we worry about the apparent disconnect between real markets and the economy probably since May, so we're really early. We believe there are three reasons for this disconnect. Central banks have slashed rates, restarted asset purchases, and obviously governments embarked into massive fiscal stimulus. This kept rates very low and kept spending power in a way up as well. 24% of the global bond market at the moment is at negative yields, which is astonishing if you think about it. And all else equal, lower yields are obviously good for risk assets through the lower discount factors on future earnings. Second reason, markets are a forward-looking mechanism. It's the collective view of all market participants on the future state of the world, not the current state of the world, that drives prices. So the view of a better economy in the future is what drives markets up today. And we believe sort of markets are looking forward 3 to 12 months on average. And given that window, the question of whether an effective vaccine will be discovered and introduced to markets becomes very relevant. And as Sonia already mentioned, we follow the research, the academic research available and the trials very, very closely. And we believe that there is sort of a 80% probability that by mid-2021 a vaccine will be widely available. This forecast, given markets are forward-looking, this forecast allows investors to imagine a world in a more normal state, kids going to school, no social distancing anymore, and what have you. The third point is what Nigel touched upon. There's a massive outperformance of mega cap technology stocks, which is distorting the sort of overall market picture. NASDAQ outperformed the S&P with 20% year to date, and the S&P X technology is actually still down for the year. I thought that was an interesting statistic to think about. This could end up in a tech bubble, but we don't think we are there yet. Nigel showed that tech technology stocks had really good earnings, so part of the difference in the re-rating or the difference in tech versus the rest of the market is simply the difference in earnings growth. And tech stocks are the logical beneficiaries of working from home, lockdown, and some future focus on automation and cost control, Nigel touched upon as well. We are, therefore, long-term, I think I've spoken in all calls about technology stocks. We are very, very positive technology going forward as well. So one, you should can take some comfort of the disconnect between markets and the economy. It's explainable. it's understandable. But having said that, we think it's gone too far as well. Hence, a cautious view on risky assets. Four reasons, I won't go into them, but earnings, we are more negative on earnings. Economic growth going forward, we're slightly more negative economic growth going forward than we think the consensus is. Geopolitical concerns, I spoke about last time, and the shorter term virus dynamics. So let me sort of close off with our positioning in a bird's eye overview. We are cautious on risky assets overall. We are now, that's probably different than last time, we're now more bearish on credits than we are on equities, actually. We prefer equities over credits, if you see it in a different way. We like artificial intelligence within technology. So we like technology, but then within that, we like artificial intelligence. We're long what we would call laggard equity sectors. Nigel spoke about the valuation differential between, for instance, value and other stocks. So we like some value. We like small caps and autos, which is in that same part of cheap equity sectors, which have lagged the recovery. Short gilts in an overall neutral position. Short UK inflation. And finally, we've taken some profits on our long gold position. That's as fast as I could go, Max.
No, Emil, that brilliant top speed. Thank you for that overview. Sonia, we've touched on a lot just now. What other major themes do you think investors will likely need to navigate over the remainder of the second half? And is there anything you'd like to add before we finish up this morning?
Thank you, Max. No, I think there was a lot in there from what Nigel, Madeline and Emil have shared, and shows you obviously that there's already this kind of differentiation going on within markets, which we've talked about, but now obviously we got confirmation from the second quarter. Now, what we haven't talked about so far is that there's obviously quite a few political events still happening in the second half and beyond, and they clearly will create a lot more headlines and volatility potentially. We've yesterday had obviously the nomination of Biden as the Democratic presidential candidate, and the US election clearly will heat up in the second half towards November. I think we have to assume that not only there will be much greater scrutiny around potential increase of corporate taxes, which was part of the Democratic proposal, so that clearly is of interest to equity markets. And we have to assume that Trump will play his kind of China bashing card a lot more. So we expect a lot more headlines around the China-US relationship towards the US election. And closer to home, I think I read earlier today that there is obviously another round of Brexit negotiations underway. So we will have a lot more headlines coming from UK-EU relationships as well. And I know that both of these obviously have been on the back burner for such a long period of time simply because of the overwhelming impact of the pandemic. But we should not forget that they're looming in the background, and clearly both of them have sufficient potential to create a lot of volatility in markets, particularly under the consideration of what we've just heard in terms of the results and obviously the valuations that come with it and how much more upside there really is across the asset classes.
Well, that's a great point on which to end this week's call. I'd like to thank you, Sonia, Emil, Madeline and Nigel for your time today. I'd like to thank all of our clients for logging in. And as ever, our podcast listeners can find a link to the slides in this episode's show notes. We'll see you again on the 10th of September, when Sonia will be joined by Ben Bennett and Chris Jeffrey.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.